Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you, moderator, for giving me the floor. I will try to walk us through the conference and the project we are here for, based on the concept note that you have all received and you should have in front of you in the program document and the structure of the program itself. It is not obvious to have a part one correlating the writings of well-established thinkers with contemporary international criminal law and a part two on foundational concepts. And as a sub-element of part two, two sessions on legal goods in international criminal law. So I will try to say a little bit about the background to this design outcome. If we now try to set out the content taxonomy of the project, at the very start, we have these elements. We have in part one, section A, five committed chapters looking at thinkers from the time of Plato up to the time of Suarez. In section B, we go from around 1600, the time of Grotius, to Hegel in the 1800s with seven committed chapters. And we go to 20th century thinkers with six committed chapters. Part one is the part of the conference anthology that will be changed the most as we publish one edition after the other. And Professor Emiliano Buiz and I are committed to having new editions appear with some regularity over the next 10 to 15 years. So there are some thinkers who are now not included in the project where we will solicit appropriate papers for future editions. There are regions that did not respond as actively to the public call for papers as did the Europeans and North Americans that are not adequately represented in part one, and we will specifically solicit papers from those regions for coming editions. We did have more than 120 qualified paper proposals in response to the call, which means that we actually had to reject more than 80 qualified paper proposals in order to have the current program and taxonomy. The second cluster starts with two papers that give a conceptual overview. One of them by Christoph Burkhardt, who is here, the other by an author who is not present at the conference. And then we move into the foundational concepts of territoriality, sovereignty, complementarity, and globality. And we have five papers for this cluster, which looks at, from a lawyer's point of view, the idea of the legal basis and legal fundamentals of jurisdiction. A second cluster on foundational concepts is so far on the notion of criminal responsibility, punishment, impunity, and truth as a foundational value and notion of international criminal law and justice. And then we move into the first of two sessions or segments focusing on legal goods with four committed papers. This will expand to five, including one on aggression in a later edition of the book, hopefully already the second edition. And finally, a session that looks clearly forward to what may be candidates for legal goods to be incorporated, to be recognized by and be incorporated into the international criminal law of the future. And this means we have three fundamental clusters that reflect the original project design as modified through the response to the call for papers in an exercise of communitarian scholarship. So what are the thematic clusters then of the project? The first is part one, the intellectual roots. The second is that of foundational concepts. And the third is that of legal goods. One focuses on the past and the other focuses on the future. And this sculpture embodies the idea of looking in two directions at the same time. This is not what we think, the Roman god of Janus. This is a much later expression of the idea of having two fundamentally different virtues. One of them, in the character looking to the left, prudence or wisdom. But this is what we normally associate with a two-faced character or god, Janus. And the Romans were exceptionally proud that this was one idea that they had not taken from the Greeks. And etymology seems to confirm that. But what etymology, more interestingly today, confirms is that the root of the word Janus most likely comes from the Avestan or old Iranian Ya, which again originates from the Sanskrit Yana. The origin of the word the Romans chose for the two-faced god of beginnings and ends may very well have been Sanskrit and Indian. What has been the place of the notion of legal goods in the development of international criminal law? Well, it started with the drive in 1945-46 by states to establish the International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg and the International Military Tribunal in the Far East. The agenda was to succeed in establishing the two jurisdictions and then to give them an acceptable legal basis, a functional jurisdiction, and a good enough legal infrastructure. This was a project that was driven by the great politics of the time of the ending of the Second World War. It was not a project that was driven by academics. It was not a project that was driven by thorough, systematic thinking and mapping. It was a project that happened in a hurried manner, and it happened in the offices of a Supreme Court judge of the United States, two, three foreign ministry lawyers, and some foreign ministers and heads of state. And some international lawyers were clever enough to position themselves vis-a-vis some of these key actors that had power at the time, such as Professor Lauterpacht at Cambridge University, who did not primarily link up to members of the British government, but to a judge of the United States Supreme Court, Justice Jackson. We quickly saw jurisprudence emerge, decisions come out of the two tribunals in 1946, 7, and 8, and it fell silent in the world of international criminal justice until the Yugoslavia Tribunal again started to issue decisions in 1994. There had been little and limited reflection before these two sequences on the foundational concepts on which international criminal law, seen from the point of view of Lauterpacht in 1944, early 1945, was about to be constructed. He did think about the idea of individual criminal responsibility under international law, he did think about the fundamental criminal law notion of criminal conduct, actus reus, within the context of international law and also of criminal intent, of punishment and jurisdiction. But it's not that he held seminars and had extensive peer discussions and that there were law review articles and multiple follow-up workshops. It was pretty much him and a couple of other persons, including Professor Hans Kelsen, again, not necessarily in his individual academic capacity, but through the work he did for one of the key governments involved. Separate from the tribunal-driven mainstream of the process, we had the process through the UN General Assembly to develop the Genocide Convention of 1948 and a separate process to develop the 1949 Geneva Conventions that included provisions on grave breaches and crimes. So this was the treaty approach to international criminal lawmaking and not let it happen through the military tribunal, the one in Nuremberg, the one in Tokyo. Very late did academia, in a more structured or organized way, become a force to be reckoned with in the development of international criminal law. Perhaps only as late as 1995, or maybe even later, can it really be called a force. It was a practice-driven process with states behind and, from the early 1990s, states acting through the UN Security Council. And what has been missing all along, what I say at the lower section, what is yet to start, is a systematic mapping, analysis, and weighing of the fundamental values or legal goods that we seek to protect by criminalizing certain conduct in international criminal law, with a view to informing the consideration of which conduct should be criminalized. So, in sum, international criminal lawmaking has been driven by the wish to set up jurisdictions primarily. That means that the scope of international criminal law developments has largely been determined by what was deemed possible in the process to make specific international criminal jurisdictions. And for understandable reasons, we have not yet seen deliberate global analysis of legal goods or even of harm, the notion of harm, in international criminal law making. Why are we emphasizing legal goods? The project does not seek to create a theory on legal goods, nor does it promote a specific definition of the term legal goods. The project is not trying to bring a German Rechtsgut theory into the discipline of international criminal law. Yes, this term, Rechtsgut, is translated into many civil law countries as the equivalent in English of legal good. It has almost a customary law function in many of these civil law jurisdictions. But we are not seeking to align the discussion to any one of these usages of the term. This is very important because the Germans, strong as they are in theory and sometimes inclined as they are to Überdogmatisierung, have developed a very sophisticated theory of Rechtsgut, which means also that there are critics in Germany of this theory. So it's a contested notion, it's a contested theory. We are not in any way seeking to import that into international criminal law. Mapping legal goods may do three things. Increase our awareness of the topography of values underlying core international crimes. Secondly, start a discourse on which additional legal goods should be recognized. And thirdly, inform consideration of which conduct should be criminalized, rather than doing it the other way around, which is what happened at Nuremberg. Which crimes do we have at the books? Not many. How can we make some now or formulate some now? And how can this hold up sufficiently for us to run some trials? It's a different approach. The term legal goods is one simple conceptual tool to think and consult more clearly about the future role of international criminal law. There is a missing link in the kinematic chain of the construction of international criminal law. That is a rigid chain that has rigid components, like a bicycle chain that has joints with some flexibility. At the center, again, was the drive to create and the necessary existence of a competent jurisdiction, underlying which is the presumption that there are some crimes that are applicable. Then follows the work processes of analysis, investigation, prosecution, review of cases. Then follows the enforcement of sentences and extensive cooperation required by states for this to function. But underlying all of that is actually the idea of legal goods, fundamental values that should be protected by the criminalization. There has been some references to the notion of harm, which is a common law notion, and which very often in the discourse is equated with legal goods. But they are actually quite different, although they take on the same function in discussions. Harm refers to what it says, harm, damage, what is caused by conduct that perhaps should be criminalized or may be criminalized. Legal goods is a try to state the positive value or the positive interest and put a name on it, put a label on it, and see if that meets with sufficient consensus or support to construct a criminalization. It is this lower part that is the missing link, we suggest, in the development of international criminal law up until now. And if we zoom in on that, a discourse on international criminal law legal goods, in order to be meaningful, should be open. It needs to be an open discourse. And the discourse community needs to be wide. It means that the political scientists are welcome. And politics is a necessity to give any effect to the recognition of a legal good, for it to enter the criminal code, or for it to enter a statute, for it to become a part of a court. But ethics is also something we need to be open to. It is meant to be the area of human knowledge that puts words to describe the norms, the fundamental norms that we believe in or that we wish to sanction. Moral philosophy. Lawyers start to become uncomfortable. Actually, we need to be open to moral philosophy if you're going to have a real discussion on legal goods. And we need to have an openness towards religion. One of the main mechanisms to affirm throughout history and in many parts of the world today, fundamental values in a society. Even, I write in the last box here, profound Upanishadic concepts such as moksha may actually be relevant to discussions on fundamental legal goods yet to be recognized in international criminal law. If you are familiar with Professor Zenner's work on the Vedantic texts, he writes beautifully on the notion of moksha, but in the context of individual yearning for change, can there be an analogous use of the term that refers to social conditions? What have we achieved in terms of creating internationally enforceable core international rights? The emphasis being on internationally enforceable core international crimes. In 1945, when the two military tribunals were to be set up, it was recognized that one can include in the statute something called war crimes, crimes against the laws of war. We can include something, it was felt, called crimes against the peace, crimes against the law on peace. After all, Hugo Grotius and others had written on this in the 1600s. There should be some basis in customary international law, it was felt. It took more discussion to add the third category, crimes against humanity. But it was added. And why was it added? It was the only way Nazi leaders could be prosecuted for what they had done to German citizens. Because the other two categories only concerned what Nazi leaders had done to citizens of other states than Germany. So, unless you wanted to have a Nuremberg trial excluding victimization of Germans, it was necessary to find a new vehicle to criminalize that conduct as well. Genocide was only created in 1948. It is mentioned in the Nuremberg Tribunal's indictment, but it was not a part of the jurisdiction. And the Genocide Convention only entered into force in 1951. When the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals ended their work, the crime of aggression actually disappears from the scene as an internationally enforceable core international crime. Today, it is not enforceable before any international criminal jurisdiction. It exists in our minds, and it may exist in customary international law. It exists as a substantive crime that can be invoked before national courts, etc. We go forward to 1993, the Yugoslavia and then Rwanda tribunals were set up. Again, war crimes was included. Crimes against humanity was included. And genocide, for the first time, was included as an operational crime in an international jurisdiction. And then we see that from 1945 until now, we actually have not evolved at all. Yes, the German ambassador correctly said that we have reached a pinnacle of the development of international law. We happen to be in Delhi and we are not so far from the Himalayas, so we see that our pinnacle is a hill. We have reached the top of the hill from where we can see the Himalayas rise in front of us. Yeah? We have not evolved at all since 1945 in terms of the core crimes that are today enforceable internationally. There has been no evolution. Next year, we are hoping that the crime of aggression will become operational in the ICC. This means a significant increase from 3 to 4 crimes that can be enforced by an international tribunal. But what about international terrorism? India is the country that has been pushing the conclusion of a general convention on terrorism, meeting resistance from Western countries, from countries that believe that whatever you do, or many of the things you do in a struggle for liberation in the name of self-determination, cannot be considered an international crime of terrorism, yeah, with reference to the Palestinian situation. So India has been pushing for many years, but still, even after the dramatic increase in acts of terrorism the last few years, there is no significant progress. The legal goods protected by a crime of terrorism are not recognized by international criminal law in the sense that they are not a core international crimes that can be internationally enforced. Now, what about the environment, crimes against the environment? Is there debate and discussion around the world today about the environment? It's one of the main issues on the agenda around the world. The interests linked to the environment are not recognized as legal goods in international criminal law. And it is the same with the third example I mentioned, international financial markets. Those who deliberately and with tremendous application of intelligence and resources design financial instruments that when markets collapse, which was foreseeable and predictable, Several million people around the world lose their jobs and their homes. Are they not enemies of humankind? We have a policy brief on the table outside, written by Philip Allitt, professor at Cambridge University, perhaps Europe's finest international lawyer today. And he says, quote, "Law cannot be better than the society that it serves. But lawyers have a duty to try to make the law as good as it can be. Nowhere is this more necessary than in international society. We have inherited an international legal system that was rationalized in the 18th century as a system for the piecemeal reconciling of the self-interest of states as represented by their governments. We must give to international law the true status and function of law in a society of all human beings and all human societies." He's calling for a fundamental upgrade of international law if you read the four pages of the policy brief. And I'm approaching the end of my remarks. As regards internationally enforceable crimes, I'm submitting that we should develop international criminal law from its 1945-48 level towards being a more adequate response to our common global problems today. We should move from the small biscuits of the three crimes that could be internationally enforced since 1945 to a normal-sized cake that addresses the needs of our time. And that, of course, means that each slice of the cake is much bigger. And that means that those countries that were not actively involved in making the biscuit in 1945 to 1948 can, with the size of their population, such as India, have a much bigger stake in the real international criminal law that is made for the future decades. Instead of quarreling about who was around the table in 1945 and 1946, maybe the time has come to make a proper cake, a proper discipline of international criminal law for coming decades. The main outcomes of the project are the open access publication of the conference anthology, and here is the cover already designed with a picture of a stem of a tree that has grown in the gardens of the Camaldoli Monastery outside Florence. I live in Florence now, so I have a bias, a local bias. So this is a monastery that was established in the 1020s, and the forest has been tended and looked after for more than 600 years. And it is absolutely magnificent and open to anyone to visit. One can take the bus from Florence, and you will find a huge variety of trees such as this, and of course the symbolism that is latent in this image we will elaborate by the time the book is published. Secondly, we put all the lectures and speeches online, and this will be done within 1 month. Both seek to reach a much wider audience than those who could attend here today. And we also seek by that to contribute to a widening of the discourse community, and to do that from Delhi, and not from The Hague or from New Haven, but from Delhi. Any discussion about widening discourse communities today should preferably take place in a city like Delhi or Beijing rather than in the United States of America or the European Union.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.